Welcome to another episode of the Bakari Sellers Podcast. I promise you guys, week in and week out, well, twice a week, actually, that I will bring you guys smart guests. And today, we actually have someone who fits right along that description or descriptor, none other than Josh Green. How you doing today?
Good. Good to be with you.
What part of the world are you in during these monsoons, if I may ask?
The monsoon outside my window is Midtown Manhattan. Yeah, I fled the monsoon in D.C. to come up here and experience it from New York.
Well, I will be joining you shortly. So, yeah, I'm not looking forward to it. Yeah. We usually start each one of our shows by having our guests walk us through the arc of their careers. And you're a national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek now. And you have written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and Vanity Fair, to name a few. When did you first realize that journalism would be your career? And what led you to the beat that you have now been covering for some time, which is national politics?
Honestly, totally stumbled into it. After college, I moved out to Boulder, Colorado with a bunch of my kind of idiot friends. And I wound up with a job working for The Onion, the satirical news weekly in Boulder, Colorado. So my first job literally was writing fake news. But it was fun. I kind of got interested in politics. I went to Northwestern, got a journalism degree, and got to work for a semester as a Washington correspondent for a little paper in Indiana that couldn't afford a real one. And my congressman got caught having an affair with his secretary, and I sort of caught the political bug.
How did he get caught with his secretary? Who told on that?
Back in the old days, it was all like whisper campaign stuff. This is like before social media, but it was kind of exciting to be the guy kind of covering it. So I like long form kind of magazine stuff and book writing. So I eventually got to the Washington Monthly, which is a kind of iconic little Washington magazine. And that led me to kind of the Atlantic and to Business Week and to book writing.
Oh, my goodness. And well, look at that. You're good at this. You're natural into book writing. That, ladies and gentlemen, that's what we call a segue. Let's talk about your new book, The Rebels, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and The Struggle for a New American Politics. What's it about, and why did you choose those three as core subjects of your book?
Well, really, it's about the rise of the populist left since the 2008 financial crisis. My last book in 2017, Devil's Bargain, it was about the rise of Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and right-wing populism. But I've always been most interested in kind of the rise of populism on the left. So in 2009, after the crisis, I was writing a freelance column for the Boston Globe, kind of got to know Elizabeth Warren, who at the time was a Harvard professor and the TARP oversight cop. That was the Wall Street bailout. You know, she was kind of brought in by Harry Reid to kind of police it. So I was spending half my day with her. And on the other half, I was a magazine writer for The Atlantic. And I was profiling Tim Geithner, Obama's Treasury Secretary. So I had this kind of...
Elizabeth Warren did not care for him too much, did she?
And vice versa. They hated each other. But it was this fascinating look at how the kind of the crisis unfolded and what became this emerging split in Democratic politics, where you had, kind of older pro-market folks like Geithner butting up against these new kind of populist Democrats like Warren. And, you know, to me, living and working in Washington, and especially after Trump's election, it just became clear that there was this huge populist backlash to the crisis. On the right, it gave rise to the Tea Party and Bannon and Trump. But to me, what's just as interesting is the rise of populism on the left, first through Warren, and then when she decided not to run for president, Bernie Sanders in 2015 and 2016, and then on to the new generation like AOC. And even the book has a kind of a weird and bit of a surprising hero at the end. It's Joe Biden, who's taken up this left populist agenda and really put together a recovery to the latest economic crash we had after COVID that's kind of gotten the economy back on its footing, unemployment low, stock market high, even though it hasn't yet translated into strong poll numbers for Biden.
Let me ask you this. Well, you said something which piqued my interest. But you said the rise of populism on the left. Would I be fair, after you've done your research and assessment, this is just a cursory view of, or opinion of mine. Would I be fair to say, though, that the rise of populism was a global phenomenon, not just...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, from Angela Merkel being attacked from the left, Trudeau being attacked from the left, Macron being attacked from the left. Hell, even Hamas ran a populist campaign and, you know, a chicken in every pot, the terrorist organization, which now runs the Gaza Strip. So talk about that rise of populism around the world.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I was embedded with Trump and Bannon kind of in the latter stages of Trump's 2015, 2016 campaign. you know, and Bannon, who's sort of like the intellectual architect of this stuff on the right, was completely convinced that, you know, this wave had already swept across Europe. We just had Brexit. He used to trot Nigel Farage, the Brexit leader, out there at Trump campaigns in Alabama, which was just the weirdest thing. But we saw the same thing on the left. Look, there's a reason that Jeremy Corbyn, right, wound up leading the Labour Party for a time in Great Britain. It wasn't just right-wing populism. People generally were kind of fed up with, you know, the state of the world, the state of the economy, and kind of the state of their own lives financially and economically in the wake of the crisis, because, you know, the truth be told, it didn't produce a satisfying recovery for an awful lot of people. Like, if you weren't a Wall Street banker, if you weren't a guy who was connected, you probably didn't get the help that you need. And so, you know, part of the history in this book, the narrative, is to kind of go back to the beginning and look how it was that Wall Street first got its claws into Democrats, how they reacted to the 2008 financial crisis, and kind of how that created this splinter group, this rising movement of left populists that I write about, which had been a part of the Democratic Party in the 30s and 40s, but really hadn't been in the 1980s and 1990s, as that kind of like economic populism gave way to things like, you know, anti-Iraq war. Liberalism was a lot about, you know, civil rights, women's rights, the environment. All of that came storming back, though, after 2008, and it made for the narrative of the rebels.
So I guess this question that I ask a bunch of folk, but, you know, it's important for this, but who's the audience for this book, and what do you want readers to take from it?
You know, the audience for the book is anybody who kind of follows national affairs, interested in kind of civics, politics, in the history of the Democratic Party. It's, you know, the cover, which is very bright, very yellow, sort of presents it almost as like a triple biography. But what it really is, it is a deep history of the Democratic Party going back to about 1978. The opening chapter is in Jimmy Carter's White House, which is where, you know, I argue Democrats Wall Street first got its claws into the Democratic Party, and kind of follows it forward from there. But anybody who's interested in kind of political history and understanding how we've wound up in the world that we've wound up in today, you know, I think would get something out of the book.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com. This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
It seems like everybody is thirsting for this type of knowledge history, because you can't really find good writing in a lot of places. Everything is a blur, respectfully. Mm-hmm. But your book is timely, to say the least. What are the new American politics you describe in the book? And contrast that with what we've seen from the Biden administration and their brand of politics, both in terms of campaigning and governing.
Well, you know, I start the book in 78, where Carter, in a lot of ways, was being buffeted by a lot of the problems Biden has today, only a hell of a lot worse, right? You had high inflation, a lot of problems in the economy, a lot of unhappy voters, a revolt in his own party. And after Carter lost Reagan in 1980, what you saw was this huge backlash among the Democrats. Anybody who had presidential ambitions kind of turned away from Carter, away from liberalism, in kind of a more pro-market direction. And that's when we saw the rise of Bill Clinton, neoliberals, third way politics, that sort of a thing, which helped transform the Democratic Party's ideology. And it took a kind of a market forward, had a tendency to kind of defer to free markets. And you saw the financialization of the party and how that worked for a time in the 90s and 2000s. It was boom times for Democrats in the American economy, and then collapsed in 2008 and kind of gave rise to this brand of economic populism, which is what I write about. I think Biden is one of the most interesting characters because I think that the Biden of today is largely misunderstood. When I came to politics in 2000, and you were probably around long enough to remember this, but, you know, Biden was a senator from Delaware. He was known as the senator from corporate America, very pro-business, very pro-Wall Street. And I think to his credit, you know, he's watched the way that the 2008 financial crisis unfolded in the White House, saw that the recovery didn't kind of work out as well for the middle class as Democrats would have wanted to, and has adjusted as president in a way where he's taken up, you know, a lot of what people like Elizabeth Warren were proposing back in 2008, 2009. You know, don't just save these banks. But let's give big stimulus payments and unemployment insurance and, you know, student loan forgiveness, small business loans, really kind of focus on the middle class. And, you know, Biden, when he got elected president, did exactly that. If you look at the COVID bailout, it's sort of the opposite of what happened relief 15 package, years earlier.
Gosh, relief package.
Relief package, relief package. Sorry about that. And look, it took 7 years after the 08 crisis to get our jobs back. You know, Biden's managed it in two. And, you know, you've got the lowest unemployment since Eisenhower. You know, 401ks are at record highs. Stock market's doing great. I work at Bloomberg. I got to give a plug to the economy. All the economic numbers are kind of turning in the direction you'd want them to be if you're an incumbent president running for re-election in November. So whether or not that's enough to get Biden another term, I don't know yet. But as a measurement of how profoundly the Democratic Party's changed over the last 15 years, I think it's a pretty good one.
Yeah, you never lied about that. How have Senator Sanders and Senator Warren and AOC fared during the Biden years? I mean, I would say that I would think just from not hearing from them as much that their influence has waned. Or have they, can you call them a success because their views have become more mainstream in Democratic politics? Have we seen the Biden administration's approach to policymaking be influenced by that brand of politics?
There's no question about it. I mean, the fact that you're hearing silence and the fact that none of my three characters decided to challenge Biden for the Democratic nomination in 2024, which all of them could have.
She wasn't
AOC turns 35 in October.
Yeah, like she wasn't old enough yet. Josh,
she is. I looked it up. She turns 35 in October, 3 weeks before the campaign. She could have run against him, but they didn't. I think shows that they understand that Biden has taken up a lot of their policies. And, you know, I was talking to a White House official doing reporting for this book, and I said, look, is this just kind of PR or like how are Warren and Sanders viewed in the White House? And the official told me, he goes, look, the people that give us headaches are Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Nobody has a problem with Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And you look at the personnel of the Biden administration, you know, riddled with people who've worked for Warren and Sanders. As Warren likes to say, personnel is policy. And a lot of Biden's personnel kind of reflect that lineage. And the fact that the Democratic Party and that Biden has kind of overseen this shift, I think shows that not only have they not lost influence, but their influence has kind of been institutionalized, like within mainstream Democrats like Joe Biden. And I think net, that's a good thing for Democrats going forward.
Does your book explore the Black progressive, like Ayanna Pressley and some others who, Jamal Bowman comes to mind, and some others who come up in that same vein? And I ask you that question, and I have a follow-up.
Yes, it does. And I mean, I think one of the reasons I chose Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as one of my three characters was for what she kind of represented generationally, right? She was the generation that was young, multicultural, graduated from college into the teeth of the recession, had lousy service industry jobs, struggled with paying for health insurance, discovered Bernie Sanders and got kind of pulled into politics. And that's a story that you see kind of across her generation that, you know, people who don't look like Joe Biden, you know, these kind of old 7-year-old white guys are now kind of the new vanguard of Democratic progressivism, whether it's, you know, Cori Bush or Jamal Bowman or any of these generation of people. I mean, the next kind of rising generation of Democratic leaders are a lot of them people of color. And I would point out, too, before you get to your follow-up question, you know, one of the things I think is important is not just that these policies have kind of filtered through to people who self-identify as radicals or progressives. you know, the fact that Biden has taken them up and that mainstream Democrats can too, to me, says that maybe the future of the party, maybe the future of the populist left is somebody like Raphael Warnock, you know, who can pull in a really kind of broad tent of Democrats, but also pull in these economic populist policies if he decides to run in 2028.
No, I've said on the show many times before that a Warnock-Whitmer ticket is pretty awesome. But that kind of feeds into my next question. So how should we read Democratic primary voters rejecting Bernie Sanders twice? I ask because in places like South Carolina and across the Deep South, where Democratic primaries are won mainly with my mom and her friends, is what I say, they rejected his brand of economic populism. Why and how does this new American politics break through the presidential primaries that are dominated in the South?
Yeah, I think the answer to that question is twofold. I do a chapter on the 2020 Democratic primaries. And I think the first problem that the populace ran into was a math problem, right? You had Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders running. So immediately you're splitting the vote right there. But I think to get to your point, the bigger problem was that a broad swath of voters, people who don't identify as radicals or progressive, people like your mom, need to feel comfortable voting for a candidate. And so far, the experience of the primaries, not just in presidential races, but in congressional races too, shows that if you as a person and a politician are coded as a kind of left-wing radical, that's going to limit your appeal. But I think that's why it's so important that Joe Biden has kind of taken up a lot of these policies that, you know, it doesn't have to come in the package of an AOC or a Jamal Bowman or a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren. Like these are ideas that Biden, you know, called himself a transitional figure. If the Democratic Party is kind of transitioning into more of a left populist party, then I think you'll see more mainstream politicians like Whitmer, like Warnock, like whoever, feel kind of comfortable taking these things up. And the fact that we as a country have kind of bounced back as quickly as we did from the COVID crash, unemployment is as low as it is, I think lends a lot of validity to those ideas and a lot of appeal. You know, even if Joe Biden doesn't wind up winning re-election, we now know that as Democrats, there is like a tool chest we can pull from to help the middle class in times of need, in times of crisis. And hopefully Democrats will be more willing to do that than they were back in 08, 09.
Was there anything that you learned about American politics that maybe you didn't appreciate in writing this book?
Yeah, the thing that stood out to me was that, you know, when I got to Washington in 2000, like there really weren't left populists. Like they just didn't kind of exist. I knew from reading history books that back in, you know, Roosevelt's era, there were a lot of them. The thing I learned doing the kind of the research and the historical reporting for this book was that they kind of disappeared in the 60s and 70s when liberalism turned its focus to things like civil rights, environmentalism, women's rights, and even like the economic stuff was more kind of Ralph Nader, consumer safety. You know, the idea of caring about like economics and bank regulation, it just came to seem not important, you know, in the 1980s and 90s until we had the crash in 08 and all of a sudden it did. And to me, the most interesting story and the reason I wanted to write this narrative was to kind of tell the story of the reemergence of that brand of left populism. And that's why I thought Warren, Bernie, and AOC were such interesting and important historical characters to write about now.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Listen closely. As a master painter carefully brushes Benjamin Moore Regal Select down the seam of the wall, it's like poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This book is fascinating. And again, timely. How much do you think Biden's approval rating is driven by progressives who, or his approval rating is kind of in the mud right now, is driven by progressives who held their nose to vote for him in 2016?
I think too much of his disapproval rating is held by those kinds of progressives. And I think the reason is that it's hard for the story of what Biden has achieved to kind of really break through in our, you know, modern news cycle, social media, with Trump going bananas and doing this and that, and everybody fighting about this. Look, I think I'll probably get stomped on for saying this. You know, I think President Biden has achieved more for the progressive left than a President Warren or a President Sanders ever could have, because he was able to come in and, you know, with this kind of seemingly moderate, non-threatening older guy who didn't code as a radical, and pull in people like Joe Manchin to do things like pass the Inflation Reduction Act, which was the largest climate bill, you know, we've had in American history, which put all kinds of money like into middle American places that had been bombed out and left behind by the 08 financial crisis, who literally came out in a State of the Union address last year. Nobody remembers this. Joe Biden came out and proposed a billionaire's tax. Like, this is the guy that used to be called the senator from corporate America proposing a billionaire's tax. I mean, to me, like, if you're a lefty, like, looking for proof of achievement and a reason to get behind Joe Biden, I think that's it right there. And then the negative reason would be, look, if Biden loses, like, rightly or wrongly, a lot of these ideas, I think, are going to be discredited. Democrats after him will be afraid to pursue kind of robust economic populist ideas like he has. So all the more reason for these people to get out and support Joe Biden. And Bakari, they shouldn't have to hold their nose. I mean, look at who's supporting him. Warren, Bernie, AOC, they're all lined up behind him. Maybe they should be a little more vocal about it. Maybe Joe Biden should say a little bit more about what he's done and get the message out there. But if you're a progressive, you know, like it or not, you should be out there in November pulling the lever for him and telling all your friends to do it too, if you want to see these kind of policies move forward in the future.
Outside of Washington, where are we seeing the left's economic populism break through the most? And what does that portend for the future of Democratic politics?
You know, I was in Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, a couple weeks ago. I mean, Trump country, like, iconic steel town, lost its mill in the 80s, you know, financially distressed ever since then. And I went there because there's a new low-carbon steel plant being built on the site of the old one that they tore down in the 80s. And I was hanging out with a Democratic mayor there, Dwan Walker, young, charismatic guy, who said, like, look, unemployment is down. We have a steel plant going up. Jobs are coming back. They're building market-rate housing in Aliquippa for the first time in 30 years. They just come out of financially distressed status for the first time since Reagan's years. So you can go out all kinds of places in America and see the effects. What Walker had said, which I think is sort of ought to be an alarm bell for Biden and the White House, though, is that nobody out here, he told me, knows that, like, this is a result of Joe Biden's policies. Yeah. He goes, Trump was out here a few years ago, and he pointed at a new plant that had gone up that Barack Obama actually kind of ushered into being. Trump showed up for the ribbon cutting, and he points to it at a big rally, and he says, I'm responsible for that. You know, and the mayor told me everybody in town thinks he is because he said he is. So I think, you know, the message for Biden is that, you know, a lot of positive things are happening from your policies, but you and Democrats have to go out there and let people know and take credit for it if you want them to vote for you in November.
Looking at 2028, what progressives do you see emerging as viable presidential candidates? And what are the lessons of Bernie 2016 and 2020 and of the Biden years that you think should be reflected in their playbook for how to break through and actually secure the White House?
Interesting. Viable presidential candidates, huh?
Viable, yeah. I think
there's a pretty good chance, she's indicated it, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is going to run for president at some point, because I don't think she really has a future statewide in New York, but you could certainly see her running as kind of a next generation Bernie factional candidate. But I think the real path forward for the progressive left, for the populist left, is going to be getting a more mainstream candidate, whether it's Warnock, whether it's Whitmer, I don't know, maybe somebody like Roy Cooper in North Carolina. I wouldn't call Gavin Newsom a progressive a progressive moderate, but somebody like that who has real broad appeal and electability to take up these policies, I think that's probably the way forward for the movement and the ideas that I write about.
And let me ask you the most important question. When will the Rebels be available, and how can people buy it, and how can they follow you on social media?
The Rebels is out today. You can hop on Amazon, go down to your local bookstore. You can buy the ebook. You can buy the audiobook. You can buy the hardcover book. You can follow me. I'm still going to call it Twitter because I feel foolish calling it X. I'm Joshua Green at Twitter. I'm Joshua Green on Blue Sky. You know, I'm out there. Would love to talk to you, be touring behind the book. Come out, say hi.
Everybody go get The Rebels. Why? Because it's a smart book, and we need more smart people writing smart books during this time of anti-intellectualism. Josh Green, thank you for joining the Bukhari Sellers podcast.
Corey, thank you so much for having me. Enjoyed it.